Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, today is a day, it's all about reality. Let's get real. Let's get real. Let's be honest with people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. About what exactly? Like,
Am I making you nervous?
It's not the honesty part. It's the letting everybody know part, you know.
It's
what's close to your heart, Tony?
I mean, in the end, French fries. You know, I mean, we can talk about all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about beautiful dishes with pigeon or rabbit or turbot or exotic fish or great octopus that got braised and grilled or, you know, various spices or highfalutin wines. But in the end,
it's all about potatoes and rice and
sweet potatoes.
Goodness.
I mean, my birthday every year when I was a kid, like, that was first kitchens I worked in. Lula Bell made me sweet potato pie every year for my birthday.
Oh,
she's Geechee, so she put coconut, toasted coconut in there.
Nice.
It was just amazing. You know, like, but that's the stuff. What's the thing for Thanksgiving when you're a kid? Is it the turkey?
No, it was the mashed potatoes.
It's the mashed potatoes.
I mean, and the stuffing, of course, but yeah, definitely.
It's starches.
Definitely. Yeah, I always used to get excited when I saw my mom bring out the mixer for dinner because I knew we were either having some sort of late, you know, last minute pastry. Like sometimes she would make cookies and then bake them right before, you know, while we were eating. Yeah. So it would be warm when they came out of the oven. Or we were having mashed potatoes. I'm like, oof, I can't believe she brought out the mixer.
But like I said, when you think about it, like the highlight, I swear, and we can talk through things sort of analytically, but let's begin emotionally.
Okay.
During the pandemic, those first weeks.
Oh, God. Do we have to talk about that?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. The thing I know that my kids remember. Two things, for sure, about that time that were just the greatest thing ever. Besides the fact that they had Dad trapped at home, and Dad would make food from anywhere, as long as he could come up with the goods.
Yeah, which was the hard part. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what I could come up with were potatoes, and I have a Staub confit pot, one of those tall confit pots.
Right.
If you don't have a real fryer in your house.
Oh, that's a good vessel.
What's the best substitute?
Yeah, that's a very good one.
Well, especially tall, narrow.
It's enamel coated cast iron. I mean, you know, you just feel so safe about frying in something like that.
Well, it's so heavy. It's not like it's going to topple.
It's big deal.
So, I mean, I used a candy thermometer. You know, blanched my potatoes. You know,
all right.
Just like proper Idaho fried potatoes. Blanched them in the oil.
Mm-hmm. Which means you pre-cook them in the oil.
But at like 250.
Get them going. Yeah.
Yeah. You get them, lay them out, cool them off, and then boom, they go back in.
Boom.
At like 375.
Or 350.
Yeah. And so for several meals during that time, like 10-week shutdown, lockdown, you know.
Fried potatoes.
I made fried chicken sandwiches. I made all kinds of stuff in that thing. But the thing that I remember is like I would just do nice piece of salmon, you know, do a little like curry mayo or something, and boom. You know, just put fresh, hot fried potatoes on the table for them.
Oh, my God. It makes me think when we opened some time ago, we opened for lunch for a period of time to see if we could do well with it.
And you're thinking about the lamb food.
I am. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. That was one of my favorite. I couldn't help but think of that when you were talking about it. I can taste that. I made a Madras curry mayonnaise for that. And the little pum pie, they weren't pum frit. They were, you know, the thin
so
ones.
Straw
it looks
potatoes,
like straw. Yeah. And the lamb rack chop. Is that what it was? I think it was lamb rack chop. And then, oh, my gosh. I mean, it was ridiculously simple, but wow. Those potatoes.
Like
with the
lamb was fine. Like the chicken was fine.
Slightly curried mayonnaise.
No, it was the fries.
Yeah.
It was the fries. So besides frying potatoes, let's talk potatoes for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
What else is on your list?
But wait a minute, because one of my other favorite things is when we do the lamb leg steak at one of the restaurants and all the juice comes out of the lamb leg steak onto that plate and you have frites on top. We used to do it that way. And then you would get all that juice in those frites. That was really good too. So in the end, a fried potato becomes a foil for sauces, for all kinds of things that you love, which is another reason why we love them. I mean, not too many people eat fried potatoes just on their own. I mean, you can, of course, but you know, it's all more fun with a sauce or something. Okay.
Two small girls in my house could eat a lot of
plain,
hot, perfectly sea-salted fried potatoes.
Oh, sea salt, right. You have sea salt at your house.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, you were saying about other potatoes.
Oh, just other preparations. For example, my girls, Olive oil crushed potatoes. I mean,
I love that. Well, it's quicker that way to just
boil the potatoes and literally.
Well, and it's inexpensive.
You pour the water off.
Right.
And right in the same pot.
Yeah, mash them up. Yeah, which is fun. It's kind of fun too.
Salt them, mash them, and olive oil
drizzle,
like cold olive oil in there.
Yeah, and you can put a little chopped garlic on there.
Yeah, but you don't need to. It's just salt, pepper,
sure,
and the oil in.
But it would be fun.
And put the top.
But
back
have you
on,
ever had
in
that in a foreign country? Because I haven't. Is that traditional in Italy? Or
I've had that in places in Italy. It's not as like completely mashed up as we'd like to do it, or as I would do it.
Okay.
But certainly I've had it plenty of times.
Yeah, it's weird because it feels like an American thing. Like American chefs kind of did that, doing it a while back.
It's an adaptation of something that's traditional.
So there's something traditional. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's a great way to do it, and it's so easy to do at home because you can just, put the potatoes, like you said, you boil the potatoes, put them in the pot. You know, you can walk around, do something else, take care of your kids, make another part of the meal, whatever. It's not, not like making, the way we make potato puree where you boil them, then you have to take skins off, then you have
to rice them.
Yeah, then you have to, put them over a double boiler, and then you have to put them through a tammy. I mean, that's like six steps.
This is kind of the opposite of critical. And,
exactly.
And the more flavorful the olive oil, the better the potatoes are. So.
Yeah, well, and the better the potatoes are, That's the other thing. So when you look for Yukons at the grocery,
Yukon Golds are a really good one for that.
Right.
Also new potatoes, little Redskins.
Oh, for crushed? Also, those are great.
Yeah.
But with the Yukons, just make sure they're golden all the way around. I've even had purveyors try and send me Yukons that were somewhat green. I'm like, you can take these back.
No.
Yeah, so that's all that they look good. The skin should look beautiful. There shouldn't be any blemishes. There certainly shouldn't be any dark spots or soft spots. And yeah, you want them to look pretty, look good, look golden and firm. And that's what you look for in a good Yukon Gold potato. But yeah, oh my gosh. So I have a friend from Colombia, from Bogota, or from the region around Bogota, and he makes a traditional potato that his grandmother used to make them, which he takes the little red ones, mm-hmm. and he boils them, and he does a nice amount, but he puts them in a pot almost the size of the potatoes. It's interesting. It's a different way of doing it, and he puts a massive amount of salt in there. And he basically just dries up the water, and then he salts them again, and and leaves the lid on and just finishes them with sort of steaming, that little mm-hmm. bit of steam left. Oh my gosh. If the potatoes are good, that's a crazy good way. It's funny because that's kind of how my mom used to make red potatoes. She loved red skin potatoes. I grew up on those for sure, but she would always heavily salt that, and unlike anything else she made. That's funny that she knew that. Interesting. Smart lady, my mom. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I guess in the 80s cooking, you would have people that would take red skins and boil them, and then before they were totally done, split them in half and grill them like on skewers.
Oh, wow.
And put them on a plate for, a piece mm-hmm. of meat or for fish or something.
That can be fun, especially if you have a wood-burning grill.
Yeah,
that
just getting a little smoke in there.
Yeah.
But do that like flat open side mm-hmm. and get the smoke up in there. Let it finish that way.
I think the best thing I ever tasted in my life, potato-wise, was my mom's scallop potatoes. That was the family favorite. And she did a really good job with it. She made them pretty traditionally in a casserole dish, and she would use milk, of course. She would never have used cream, which is what I use. And, probably bought the best cheese she could find, which wouldn't have been probably very good when we were kids.
Yeah.
You couldn't get great Reggiano. Or
could have been Jarlsberg or something.
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. Or maybe she used a cheddar. She might have used a cheddar.
Yeah.
But, cheese wasn't, no good cheeses were available when we were kids, really, unless you went to a foreign country or knew a local cheesemaker. So it's, those scallop potatoes were so good. And I remember eating them because I was the youngest in my family by far. When I was little, I was at home with mom. My mother didn't work. And so I would often have, she would make me lunch. And we would often have those scallop potatoes the next day with maybe a little piece of roast beef or something. And I just remember thinking how lucky I was that I got to finish up the scallop potatoes.
Yeah, potato gratin, I love making it. Almost only ever make it at the holidays. A lot of times at Christmas, I'll make it, in the gratin dishes, the big guys, and just layer Yukons. I always do some garlic and some onion, some shallot, all three, just sweated.
Oh, okay.
Lay them in the bottom of it, and then cook the entire thing in butter.
Yeah. Oh,
your style.
For sure.
And then just lay potatoes, you know, a couple layers of thin slices, some Gruyere, more or Comté. Comté is better.
I love Comté.
And then more slices, more Comté. Mm-hmm. And then just bathe the whole thing in cream and lots of little gobs of butter as well.
And, yeah, salt and black pepper.
Yeah, salt and pepper all the way through.
Yeah, I don't like to put garlic in mine unless there's a reason, like, you know, maybe I'm serving it with venison or something.
There's,
you know,
it's a good have reason. Something. It's called happiness.
But I have taken a garlic clove and just rubbed the bottom of the pan, which you can't believe how much that actually has an effect. And I always, when I make gratin, I always like to put butter in the bottom. I do. I like that bottom layer to get nice and brown and crunchy. Crispy, yeah. And yeah, I use Gruyere and aged Reggiano and cream and salt and pepper between the layers. Then the other fun one is Parmesan, which I'm in love with Parmesan.
Yeah, you make good Parmesan.
Oof, we have those. You know, if you all listen to the radio show a lot, we talk about these steel pans, and those are the perfect pans for Parmesan. And duck fat is the most wonderful thing to cook them in. If you can get your hands on duck fat, if not, just use, you know, you can use corn oil or canola oil, neutral oil, and you can always add a little bit of butter later on or not. But yeah, you get your pan, well, you slice your potatoes, and you got to move fast. You slice your potatoes pretty thin and get that pan hot, put the oil in, and you start that first layer. And also be careful. I'm a professional chef, so I'm not scared to put a whole bunch of potatoes in a hot pan with hot oil, but you want to be very, very careful. It can't, and especially if there's any water involved at all, which there shouldn't be. You want to wash your potato, peel it, slice it on a mandolin. You are not going into water. No. That's why you have to move fast, because they will begin to oxidize immediately. So maybe it's a two-person project. And, you know, you get them sliced, you start going into the pan, you make your first layer, and then you start just evenly going around and around. I usually do 4 to 5, maybe even 6 layers. And then the fun part and the dangerous part is you flip them over.
Do you ever layer them ahead of going in the pan?
No.
No.
Not for that. No. No, because it's a lot. So I just go.
I'll admit, on a big, broad spatula, I've done that where I just layer them.
Well, I make big ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I make, you know, the size of the pan ones. We also do the little crispy potatoes for smoked salmon and like foie gras sometimes. Yeah. That's only one layer. That we do out ahead. We do those. We usually, again, work as a team, have a sheet pan, and you do one layer. So go. You make it the size of the pan, and then you can, and then I put on 4 or 5 pans, but, you know, again.
Yeah. I've got that giant copper saute pan. You've seen that
yes,
thing.
Yes, of course.
It's like 70 pounds.
Yeah.
That you can do, you know, 5 or 6 of the spatula sized.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
nice.
Like a big spatula.
That's fun. Right. It's fun to do those things. It's also a skill building. You know, if you are brave enough to just make sure you don't have too much fat in the pan. That's how you keep from burning yourself when you're flipping.
My helpers have to grow a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, they
like
do.
That.
That's adult work. That is not kid work for sure. Yeah. But it's a good skill builder. By the way, just as an aside, one of the best ways to learn how to saute or toss food in a pan is with inexpensive dried beans. And just put them in a pan, a lot of them in a pan, something you don't care about, that didn't cost much of anything, and just, you know, start flipping the pan and practice and practice and practice.
Learn the wrist motion.
Yep,
exactly. So, all-time disappointing potato dish. You got 30 seconds.
Oh, God, I don't know. Oh, you're going to have to go.
I don't have something in mind.
Oh.
I know, but you know what it is? Like, you read menus sometimes, and you see, and you're like, oh, this is going to be great.
Huh.
You know, I mean, I recall at Pierre Gagnère having a potato mousse that sounded like it was going to be interesting and like light and airy.
Well, yeah,
and
it sounds amazing. What the heck is potato mousse?
Well, there's clearly egg whites in there.
Ew.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And it just did gnarly things to the texture. It was a little bit like a potato balloon.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Yeah, I do not want to eat a potato balloon.
I don't recall ever having any
a
disappointing.
Nice starchy balloon.
Potato courses.
I'll
tell you what disappoints me is when somebody doesn't know how to make potato puree. They allow the potatoes to absorb too much water, and then the potatoes taste, first of all, the texture is horrible, and it tastes like watered down potatoes. What are they doing? Yeah. The potatoes are absorbing water to cook. That's the process of the cooking process. And you don't want them to absorb too much of that water. It's like pasta. If you overcook pasta, if you overcook risotto, if you overcook any kind of rice.
Yeah, you can overcook potatoes.
Just like any starch,
there's a sweet spot.
Yeah, well, and even professional cooks, it's not like they magically know how long to cook a potato perfectly. It's something you have to teach people. And, you know, you want a large amount of water. You don't want it in a small. I remember I had a cook that used to insist on putting water just to cover the potatoes. I'm like, no, that's the wrong way to do that. You need a lot more water than that in that pot. It was so weird.
It'll take too long.
Well, it also isn't enough water.
But if it takes too long to cook, then.
Yeah, it's awful. All the way around.
Then you really
wrong.
Saturated the water.
Yeah,
it's just that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good Lord. Yes. When we come back on Farm to Wolf from Food and Wine, hopefully we'll recover from the potato trauma and we'll move on to the happy land of rice. When we return on Farm to Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy, I'm trying to shake off the thoughts of that potato mousse. I was just like,
I don't know. Sometimes people try too hard. You know, I think that's one of the things about cooking is that, well, you know, honestly, it's just, you were talking about being honest. Well, cooking, if you're honest with your cooking, if you're just trying to get the best product you can and take care of it the best way you can and put it together with something that it complements and complements each other. Everything needs to be in perfect harmony on the plate. That's what it's all about. That's what I tell every cook when I hire them. We're not doing anything to set the world on fire. Right. I am not interested in doing something new. I love walking
around. There isn't anything new.
There isn't any. Well, there is if you break it down chemically and alter it. But to me, this is my opinion. It's not satisfying. And that's what that's what we all strive for, all of us, is that we strive to make the best the food can possibly be. And oftentimes that can be very, very simple. And we're talking about a product that's very, very simple, starches. And they're inexpensive, which makes so many different cultures.
Some are more than others, but yeah.
Can
we talk about rice?
Please, I could talk about rice all day long.
It's funny. When I was a kid, that was my happy thing. My great-grandmother was definitely a master of rice. Rice was at every meal.
She was from the South, she was a true Southerner.
Well, South, not that far from the coast, and that was just expected. You know, there would be biscuits, there'd be cornbread, but there's always rice.
Yeah,
you know, that's something that because there's always juice, there's always gravy, there's always something that rice that wants the rice.
Well, and you have to feed people. You need a starch to feed a lot of people. You know, I read
lots of stews and then rice on the side, and then
One of my favorite Low Country cookbooks, the writer talks about how she went to, when she was a school child, she went to another friend's house for lunch and ran home crying because they didn't serve rice at lunch, you know? And I'm like, wow. I mean, that's just so right. And rice was served at every meal pretty much in one way or the other in the South, especially in the Low Country.
Well, certainly the dominant grain of the world.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I was saying. It's such an important product to so many different cultures and so many different countries, and so many people live off of it almost.
You have the perfect, like, foolproof, simple method to make basmati rice at home.
Oh, basmati? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
So that's just... Tell the world so they can solve their basmati rice problems.
Sure, you need a big pot of water. So, you know, I don't ever measure anything, so it's a little hard for me to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is maybe not the most helpful recipe ever.
You need a large pot of water and the basmati rice. So my brother-in-law is from Iran, so this is how I learned about making basmati, because I love tariq, and I love all the dishes, actually, that he or his mom or my sister have ever made that's Persian cooking. And the biggest thing is you get a really high-quality rice. Now, I've noticed that sometimes you can buy it in a burlap bag, and I cannot stand the smell of burlap, and it does permeate the rice. So I would strongly suggest buying a brand that does not house the rice and burlap. And you have to rinse it 6, 7, or 8 times in cold water. So you put the rice in a bowl and have, you know, probably about 4 inches above the level of the rice water. And it's kind of a a wonderful process. You just keep running your fingers through the rice and loosen up the starch. And so it, you know, it starts to become cloudy, the water. So you do that, you drain it, new water, do it, drain it 8 times. Let's say, just say 8, probably 6 might be enough. And then you let it soak in fresh, cold water. You're not in hot water. That's the only reason why I say cold. It could be room temperature, but definitely no hot water. And so it sits there. And then when you're ready, and you can do that the day before, which is nice. You can take that one step out of your way and leave it in the refrigerator. That's what we do at the restaurant.
How long does it soak?
It could soak for 30 minutes or 24 hours. It doesn't have to be one or, yeah. So let's say you just did it and you're soaking now and you're getting all your dinner ready and you're, you know, grilling pork chops or whatever it is, and you've got your vegetables or your little, slow cook stewed vegetables, whatever it is that you want to serve with the rice, and you put on a big pot of water with a nice amount of salt, and it would really be the same amount of salt as anything, potatoes, whatever. There's no more, no less, and you bring that to a boil. And so this is the unusual thing about basmati, is that you want it to freely roam in that boiling water. It's loose in there. Whereas if you make, let's say, Uncle Ben's rice, it's a very different process. So basmati flies around in there, and the mamá de sal dente, which is usually like, I don't know, 7 minutes, 6 minutes, maybe 5. Start at 5. Test it at 5. And you want it to be al dente, but obviously not undercooked, and you certainly don't want to overcook it. And then you just drain it through a fine mesh sieve, and then you do what you want. In order to make tarig, you then put oil in the bottom of the pan, and you need the perfect lid for the pot and a good kitchen towel.
You need a proper seal.
Yeah, you need a proper seal. You need a good kitchen towel that doesn't have a bunch of dish chemical and stuff on it. You know, a clean towel, preferably washed, maybe rinsed off in cold water. That's a good idea. Just rinse it in cold water to get some of the detergent that you might have had on there. And a clothespin if you have one, if not, like a paper, potato chip thing, you know, whatever those things are called.
A clip. Yeah.
And so you then put the oil in, you put the rice in the shape of a pyramid, and then you take a wooden spoon and you use the I don't know how to describe this on the radio. So you're basically making 5 holes from the top to the bottom, mm-hmm. so that the steam escapes properly through this pyramid. Mm-hmm. And then you put the towel on the lid, put the lid on super tight, and it usually takes almost 30 minutes to make the tarik. You have to be on low heat, and this is a bit of a, you're going to fail maybe 1 or 2 times. It's I've even seen my brother-in-law maybe, you know, have cook it too hard and it gets too dark. So it's really knowing your stove, but it's worth the effort because it's crunchy and golden, and I mean it's just prized by the culture. You know, it's with every meal. It's that tarig is the, you know, very important part of eating dinner.
So for me, I'd love to have basmati, but put cardamom pods in at the end.
I love cardamom.
When it, you know, let it steam in there at the end.
Do you buy that at the cardamom store?
I buy that at a funny little Pakistani grocery.
Good.
Where I get
by Hopkins?
Yeah.
I haven't been there in a while. Where I get lots of
whole spices.
Oh,
yeah.
I haven't been there in a long time. That place
is great.
They
always have good
first
things. Yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
if you're nice to me, I'll tell you.
Oh, boy. I know where it is. Jeez, I'm glad they're still open. Ooh, you can get food there, too. Yumminess.
So let's go back from basmati. So cooking Uncle Ben's rice,
right,
or something like that.
Okay, so this is foolproof, all right? Well, yes. So you...
This is largely foolproof.
Largely foolproof. A good pot, a good heavy bottom pot. Put your pot on. You want a lid for this pot. Again, a well-fitting lid. And butter in the bottom, onion, shallot, small dice. Work it. Do not caramelize it. It should just be translucent. And then you add whatever amount of rice you want to make. Let's say it's 2 cups. You cover it with water or chicken stock or fish stock or shrimp stock or lobster stock, whatever, vegetable stock, whatever it is that you're making. And the up to 2 fingers horizontally above the level of the rice is the perfect amount of liquid. Once it comes up to a boil, taste it. because you need it right from the very beginning. This is another thing I tell my cooks. Oh, well, I'll season it now. Really? No, you season it from the very, very beginning. You want the rice to absorb all the flavor that you want it to absorb from the very beginning. And really, you should always keep that in mind with any starch. It's absorbing, it's absorbing. If it's absorbing a lot of flavor from the beginning, what do you think it's going to be like? What do you think happens if you only let it absorb a little bit at the end? What do you think it's going to taste like? So if you really want
it. If you just salt it at the end, it's meaningless.
Oh, forget it. Yeah.
You use twice as much and have no taste.
Yeah. So, and also my little trick is, because I do like butter, it depends on what I'm serving it with, but I will put a pat of butter, you know, like, I don't know, you know, for 2 cups, maybe a couple tablespoons, just on top and put the lid on. I like the butter to do its work.
So hang on. So you take the rice.
I bring it up to a boil.
That has 2 fingers above it to a boil.
Yeah, it has to come up to a boil.
And
right.
Then?
And well, then I taste it for all the seasoning. Mm-hmm. And then I turn it off, put the lid on, and put it on absolutely the lowest setting or off. It depends on your stove, especially if you have heat. Like our ovens are always on. So see, again, our situation is so different in a restaurant kitchen. We're always, you know, producing heat, and the kitchen's hot on top of that. So normally you can just sit it on the back of the stove and turn it off. And that's what I would do. I would not leave it on. And then, you know, 7 minutes later, 8 minutes later, whatever, fluff it up and you should be ready to go or check it. Maybe it'll be longer, but yeah.
Okay.
That's Uncle. And, you know, great. I make Tabasco rice. I make Tabasco. I would add Tabasco tomato paste to that. Very simple. Use chicken stock. You know, there's a lot of great rices to make. You could just do a curry rice. You could make a saffron rice. You can make one with a little bit of chili powder in there. Put some poblano peppers in there. Lots of things you can do.
So there are two pretty elaborate short grain rice that we should talk about making. One is risotto, mm-hmm. which usually make with carnaroli rice or mm-hmm. aquarello.
Mm-hmm.
And then one is, you know, like calaspara
paella?
Rice. Paella, you think of paella or, you know, the Spanish rice.
Yeah.
And there are two types. There's dry and they're called húmedo. You know, there's dry and there's wet or moist.
Mm-hmm.
I know the world doesn't want that word any longer, but
mm-hmm. I will say that
they're different products.
A lot of people ask me in the dining room, so what's your favorite thing on the menu, or what's your favorite thing to make? And I will say, soups are absolutely my favorite thing to make. Sauces are absolutely, and the other is risotto. I almost always make Until recently, I have made almost every single pot of risotto out of my kitchen because I love making it. I love the process, and I love making risotto with la bomba, which is the Spanish rice that is traditionally made into paella.
It's a different short grain.
Right.
And that's calaspara rice, so it's not carnaroli.
Right. And any of those rices are great to make risotto.
But the method is the same.
Right, exactly.
The method is the same, and in the end, it's just from a different place.
And now you're really proving the point of get all the flavor in there from the beginning so that really, you know, and as you're adding liquids, you're, you know, alternate. For example, I make a Barolo risotto, and I like to use our really good chicken and veal stock, but I also use a tremendous amount of red wine to make that risotto. So in order for it to be balanced, so when you're making risotto, you saute, again, sweat the onion and the shallot, whatever it is you're using, in butter. And then you have to toast the rice. Please don't take that to mean it turns brown or golden. You're not making the rice look different color-wise. You are simply working the starches in that rice in fat, right? So you're sort of toasting it. I believe we do call it that. And so once you've done the shallot, onion, and butter, you add the rice, and then you just, on low heat, you're letting it cook for a couple of minutes and moving it around so it cooks evenly, and then you begin to add liquid. So I always have my pot for my risotto, recognizing what the volume is going to be, that's big enough for what I'm going to make, and then the pot on the back with boiling liquid, all right? And I have a ladle for that boiling liquid. Then I turn, when I'm ready to make it, I turn my boiling liquid down to a simmer. I make sure everything tastes right, and then I start to make the risotto. You want to take it from there?
Well, what's interesting, just listening to the methodology, so when, it's funny, you're using the Spanish rice, and you're talking almost the same way that Jorge Ordóñez does about when you make, you know, paella.
Sure.
And that it's got to be boiling. And it's funny because we'll a lot of times we'll make risotto where it's warm, but we also don't use brown chicken stock. We'll use, it's always either white veal, white chicken, or fish, you know, or lobster stock, mm-hmm. or shellfish, you know, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But it's never the caramelized
brown stock.
Yeah, it's just a...
where the bones are not roasted. Well, that is very different.
In the end, risotto is something, rice dishes come down to the cook.
Absolutely.
It comes down to the cook, because there's a certain amount of like, well, I'm going to say, this is correct, or that's like, I know what I believe to be so.
Right, there is no correct.
And I know I can get a delicious result, mm-hmm. and I know that you get a delicious result. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
That's fun about cooking.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And that's what's fun about exchanging ideas in cooking.
Yeah.
Because we all... Or learning about other people's cultures, because we all have our way of doing it. And then, gosh, you know, maybe that your way influences my cooking, or mine influences yours, or I just don't do it my way and I do it your way. Well, how fun is that?
Exactly. So I like to make risotto not with stock so much, but with brodo.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a little bit more reduced, but it's also not caramelized.
Right.
You know, it's funny. There's just a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And there's certain ones that you make, like risotto milanese, you know, we use the marrow, but maybe you use the pieces of bone, literally toast them in the pot with the rice and then pull them, you know, and the marrow is part of what finishes it with the butter and the parmigiano, mm-hmm. you know, the saffron goes in there sort of midstream.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah. I don't do it that way. I make a saffron broth first. And actually, if a cook didn't do it that way, I'd be unhappy about it. So that is interesting. But, you know, what I want.
No, I mean, literally doing that, you get it started with the naked brodo.
Okay.
And then you have the warm mm-hmm. on the stove.
Okay.
You know, and that's what gets the saffron. And once the rices begins to take the other liquid, then you come in with the saffron.
So the process, once you've started to add liquid, you should always add enough liquid each time to absolutely cover the rice, but not go too far above the level of the rice, right?
Yeah.
Because you want it to cook evenly. That's only, again, I've seen,
And it's got to move.
Yeah, sharing my experiences teaching cooks how to do things. So it's always have enough liquid to cover it. And then once it's really starting to absorb, then you add the next batch of liquid. And this is where you may be alternating. So I would go between stock and red wine. I'd have rosemary in there. I might be adding a little bit of Tabasco because I like it in there. Salt and pepper from the very beginning. And I constantly keep checking the way it tastes while I'm making it. And you're constantly stirring because you're working those starches out. And then you finish, you decide, well, is it appropriate to have Reggiano in here at the end? Great. If not, don't put it in.
Yeah, I mean, how risottos get finished is, it really depends a great deal on what you want the end result to be and what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
Seafood.
Mm. No. Cheese, pretty much.
Yeah. No. Butter, yes. Cheese, no.
Butter for sure.
You're in the North.
And you can undercook it and serve it later. That's the other thing.
Well,
you've got to cool it down quickly.
You got to spread it out to mm-hmm. cool it. Otherwise. Yeah.
We use a big, wide, narrow pan.
All that being said, man, there are Italians that will tell you right away.
Well, again, I'm talking from a
practical mm-hmm. standpoint. Mm-hmm. I understand. Mm-hmm. That's one of the really luxurious things. We do a big event that has a risotto. We can time it. Like, you know, this is for 40 people.
Yeah,
this
that's
is
nice.
For 40 people. This is the size pot. This is going to be a 28-minute process.
Yeah.
You know, you literally set your watch and
it is nice when you can cook
it done.
From start to finish.
My favorite we've done in a while has been, we had the wilted over spinach.
Yes.
And making a spinach puree. Mm. And then not from the beginning, because the color would be nothing, but towards the end, just making a really beautiful neutral with veal stock, white veal stock, risotto, and that. And then braised beef short rib as a garnish, almost like a little ragu.
Nice.
You know, just drizzle of that on top.
Mm. Nice.
And a little nutmeg shaved.
Yeah, my farmer has some
great
spinach.
When we come back, and this is a long segment, sorry guys, Foreman Wolf will address the other parts of rice and other fun starches. Boy, we go down rabbit holes on this stuff.
Well, it could be pasta.
Could be. That's not a starch. No. That's a whole.
That's its own show.
Stop it. That's a series of programs on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
This program is replete with
makes me hungry.
With thoughts. So we're kind of working on the big three starches. We're working on potatoes and rice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many different categories and variations within each one.
Yeah.
And now let's talk about corn. That's the American grain, right?
Right. I'll not forget developing the recipe for cornbread at a restaurant you and I opened in D.C. when I started doing low country food in a restaurant. And it was, there were so many recipes for cornbread and different, oh my gosh, and everybody, even down to a lady, the cook in that kitchen, oh, well, that's too much sugar. That's not enough sugar, whatever, or what's the ratio?
Everyone's opinions are like.
It's a very personal thing, cornbread. I remember that was one of the biggest comments I got going out into that dining room when we opened that restaurant. Well, this cornbread's great, or your cornbread's too sweet, or I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't make all you people happy.
Because you're competing with someone's grandma.
Exactly. This is hard.
Grandma always wins. There's no.
It's funny, though, but we opened that restaurant in 1993. I have been doing that exact same recipe since 1993. Well, Abaldo has, actually.
You've been doing cornmeal fried oysters since then, too.
I have, which is crazy, since 1990. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
That's a while.
That's a lot of fried oysters and a lot of cornbread. We also served biscuits there. But anyway, we're talking about corn. So I think, also when it comes down to with cornbread is the grind of the corn, and for ours, if it's too fine, it's it's a little bit like Goldilocks. If it's too fine, it doesn't work. If it's not fine enough, it doesn't work. So you have
you need just the right crumb.
Yeah, you need to find the one that's right for your recipe. Ours is somewhere in between, and there's only one purveyor I can buy it from. They're the only ones that have it, and I hope they never go out of business because I need that cornmeal, and it's the same cornmeal obviously that we use for the oysters. So yeah. And the other thing is when we make something like fried chicken, we'll do cornmeal and all-purpose flour mixed together, and then that grind on that cornmeal becomes important there too. So it could be a baking product, it can be a frying product, whatever. So. It's cornmeal is, and you want it to be fresh. You want to feel that like the producer is making it and sending it to you if possible.
Yeah, you can smell it.
You don't want it sitting in a warehouse for a year. I hope those days are behind us, because that is the way it used to be. I don't know about a year, but I know a lot of product used to sit in warehouses and shipping, and grocery stores would buy huge amounts of product and they would just sit on it. And the fact that from Anson Mills, you can, call them and they grind it and send it to you. I mean, from an heirloom variety corn makes a huge difference to the taste. So I cannot suggest that more. Get it from a good supplier, especially since you don't have to buy 50 pounds for your house, I don't think.
Yeah, no.
So,
Unless you have a really big huge family.
Yeah. You're probably buying 5 pounds, or 10 pounds. And with cornbread, I use buttermilk in mine. And that's another thing that's subjective, it's kind of up to you.
I love
the buttermilk in there. Cornmeal, buttermilk, all-purpose flour, a little corn oil, salt, sugar, and that's what's in eggs. And that's what's in there.
I tell you what, I love when I was a kid, just corn cakes, different kinds of corn cakes. Like,
yes.
If my grandmother, if she was making crab anything, there'd be little bits and pieces of crab left.
Yeah.
And she'd make corn cakes, like with onion, with crab meat, fry them in bacon fat.
Sure.
A little bit of like spring onion and sour cream on them. Oh,
she
my
had
God.
It. It was why not use it?
Using everything. So.
Why would you use butter when you've got bacon fat sitting over in the
Always
jar
happy
over
to
there.
Shuck corn for her.
Ooh.
To crush it, mash it up in a bowl, with.
Oh my God! You know what that makes me think of? You remember how I used to make corn fritters? I haven't made those in years.
Yeah.
I have to find that recipe. Ooh, we used to serve those hors d'oeuvres for banquets back in the day when we first opened, and so I think I probably did that in D.C. too. I don't remember. It was probably the other restaurant. In Fells Point, that's probably where I started. But anyway,
you could put a dish on that was corn fritter roulette.
Oh,
and fry a couple
of
cornmeal coated chicken livers in there.
Oh, that would be yummy.
Well,
that's another thing I do with cornmeal. We make a cornmeal breading procedure for our chicken livers, which we marinate the chicken livers in buttermilk, which makes them much better. And man, I'll tell you right now, if you're going to do chicken livers, you better get a fresh product, because the fresher they are and the better feed they live off of and better environment they have when the chickens are healthier, the chicken livers can be very, very good. But yeah, marinate them in buttermilk and into the same cornmeal breading procedure as our fried oysters, and fry them at 350. And you want them to be sort of pink still, not red, but, you know, a little bit pink on the inside, so they're not cooked totally hard or all the way through well done. They'll be a little bit better if they have a little bit of tenderness to them.
A little less irony.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, they have a lot of blood, right? Iron.
What else do you like to do with corn? I mean, polenta and grits are the two obvious.
If I had to have a choice for breakfast every morning, out of all these things, I would love to have polenta each morning, just a little bit even. We make ours with cream, a little bit of chicken and veal stock, and salt, and that's it. And it is a 4-to-1 ratio, so 4 cups of liquid to 1 cup of polenta. And it takes about 35 to 40 minutes on very, very low heat. And man, do you need to stay on the bottom of that pan in the corners. You have to keep that pan clean and on low heat so it's not scorching or burning. And just keep moving it around. It's a starch. It's a little bit like risotto in that the more you stir it, the nicer it's going to turn out. So,
last week we were making polenta in a Trentino style dish with braised rabbit.
Okay.
And oh my goodness.
I need to get some.
You know, with its own stock and some of that nice wintered over those thyme bushes that are
they're
so incredible pretty. Flavor.
I can't believe
it's
they did so
flavor.
Well over the winter time out front.
And that's a very happy moment. It's interesting. Wine with polenta is one of the few starches that really kind of alters your wine choice, because there is that natural sweetness. And the starch, it like absorbs differently, whatever the sauce is. So, and it sort of colors the flavors of whatever the item is. So with the rabbits, you can go white or red. And it's just a question: do you want to complement it or build on it with a white, some kind of rich Chardonnay or something like that, or do you want to cut it? And a lot of times, there's a red from the region, the grape Toroldo Rotiliano. It rolls right off the tongue, right? Toroldo Gortigliano.
No one has any idea
it's,
what
it's
you
a
just
relative.
Said.
It's a relative of Syrah. It's from Trentino. Fortadori is the best producer of it.
I love her.
Yeah, Elizabeth is
great.
She's
amazing.
My son Mateo is making the wine now, and he's
that's
really
neat.
Brilliant kid.
Well, we met her when she had just sort of taken over.
Yeah,
right,
not
her
long
father.
After. Yeah.
Wow, that's neat.
But she's tremendous, and that. It's a red that has that medium to full build, but it's not that tannic. A little bit like Syrah can be. A lot of European Syrah is just not that tannic. It's not incredibly fruity, but it cuts exactly right. It's like the little bit of black pepper almost to it.
Nice.
And I'd like that very much with that dish.
Very good.
So, but corn definitely changes. It's funny, the American Chardonnay, corn and lobster, the two things is like ding, 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 wants like big, rich, toasty, you know, the Sonoma Coast Chardonnay from Dallinger or Reese or somebody like that.
Well, you can always make polenta with water. You don't have to make it with milk or cream, with dairy product. It just has a different
effect. Or you can make it with rabbit stock.
Yeah, rabbit stock.
And a little bit of cream to finish.
Right.
Yeah.
We make crispy polenta that way with water or a little bit of stock, depending on if we want it to be vegetable or not, a vegetarian or not. And then right now we're putting a little bit of roasted poblano pepper in the mixture and then cut them into, you know, sort of long, narrow pieces and fry them in peanut oil. And that's really quite good. I think it would be worth it to try that at home. Frying at home is not easy, and it does tend to get on the walls of your kitchen, you know, if you do it all the time. I mean, it flies through the air. I mean, that's just a fact.
That's why I have that giant tile back wall.
yeah. That's when but I mean, it might be worth it to make some crispy polenta or some cornmeal fried oysters at home, play around with
it. That's what we started this program with.
Yeah.
With french fries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's worth the try. You don't have to do it all the time, just once a month or something. Do something fried.
Yeah, that it's funny. Grits are what my great grandmother would, if she was going to do a fish fry, which always meant pan fried, not deep fried.
Right.
But she would, you know, do get a piece of, you know, croaker or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a couple of little croaker fillets and cornmeal batter them and fry them in the pan. And
would she lay the fish on the grits?
Yep.
Or,
yep.
Yeah.
On the grits, little mustardy, spicy pickles.
Nice.
Along with that. Yep.
We have that in common. My grandmother made the best pickles, and my aunts and my mom. I love pickles.
I was like 8 years old, and I couldn't have the beard that it needed.
Oh, guess not.
No, but I can taste it in my mind right now.
I love grits. Well, and with grits, we make them with milk. And that makes, you know, by adding milk and a little bit of butter, it just, you know, the starch content makes it creamy all on its own, so you don't have to use cream. Actually, I've never made grits with cream.
I have to say, I heard someone talking about, I would have to wrap up here in just a moment, about my all-time favorite thing as a kid, vegetable-wise, was succotash, always, but the real thing. And I heard people talking about succotash the other day, describing a bunch of vegetables all tossed together as succotash.
So what is succotash to you?
To me, it's lima beans, it's corn, it's onion. You know, you can throw something else in there, but...
Well, it's corn and lima beans.
Corn and lima beans, yeah.
In butter? Or is there dairy product? Milk or...
In butter.
Okay.
A lot of black pepper.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But you get a little bit of the starch out of both and...
I love lima
that's
beans or butter
so
beans.
Great. I'd rather have that with fried chicken than mashed potatoes or anything else in the whole world.
Yeah, I used to serve fried chicken that way, but I did add at one point in time a little bit of Brunoise zucchini to it, but I know that's not traditional.
Yeah, which is good. And I've had it where there was a little tomato tossed in there when there's just mm-hmm. a million tomatoes around. It's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different thing, but
yeah,
it's really just the sweet and the starch all at one time. That's for me when I was a kid. That's, you know, and shelling shucking the corn and shelling the beans for my great-grandmother, you know,
that's fun. It's rewarding.
Yeah.
Helping out and...
Yeah. And then getting
the reward.
Getting that, maybe some biscuits. And, yep, exactly.
Did she make her biscuits in a skillet or in the oven?
In the oven.
Yeah, because you can do skillet cornbread and you can do skillet biscuits. So it's...
Yep.
And when I say that, I mean an old cast iron pan.
Skillet cornbread. Hard to beat that. Mm. That's my last thought on this program, thinking about that. If you wish to email correspond with us, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. If you want to download this program or any one of our others, go to the WYPR website, wypr.org, and look for the Foreman Wolf page. There should be a menu of goodies there for you. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook as Chef Wolf.
And on Instagram, I'm The Real Tony Foreman. And thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.